This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
Welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry here with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
We're recording after the close today, December 2nd. I can't believe it's December already. It's the last couple of weeks have been a whirlwind. I think just having four soccer games on every day has taken some of my attention, I would say.
Yeah, it's definitely getting into the home stretch here, but I did watch a couple matches. And it's a bit more exciting, a lot less flopping this time around, it seems like, or at least my memory is just wrong, but I didn't see too much flopping going around, at least in the matches that I watched. So that was always nice to see.
And tomorrow morning, 7 a.m. Pacific, we'll see the U.S. plays Netherlands. So, Sam, I don't know if that's one of the matches you're also going to be watching, but should be a good one.
Yeah, I'm going to try to watch it. And I am happy that you said it was 7 a.m. Pacific, because for some reason I thought it was at 6 a.m. So you're giving me another hour of siesta time on that. So thank you.
Well, unless you want to watch the hour-long pregame show, it's 7 a.m. kickoff.
Yeah, it's a negative.
All right. I figured. So at least those listeners listening on the Friday afternoon know 7 a.m. kickoff on Pacific. And it's not, it's not like American sports where it's like 7:07 or 7:12. It's like 7 o'clock on the nose.
Yeah, they are punctual.
All right. Well, why don't we get into where are we? We finished through November here, and let's summarize. And we have two weeks worth of data for people. So why don't we summarize what happened in November and so far where we are in the year?
Yeah, sounds good. So on a week to date basis, looking across the board here, it's pretty strong for both the equity market, U.S. equity market, and the bond market. On the week to date, the S&P 500 is up 1.2%. Looking at it on a year-to-date basis, it helped cover some of that negative return. It's now down over 13% on a year-to-date basis. It's definitely covered a lot of ground there, from where the depths of where we were on earlier, where we're down in the down 20% type of handles at some point so far in 2022. So it's nice to see, I guess, we'll take that negative 13. Let's just see if we can improve it in this final month of 2022. But looking across the various sectors underlying the S&P 500 through December 2nd, I now see four sectors positive with a green color on the year-to-date print. Of course, energy is still up there, up over 68%. That's followed by consumer staples, which is a new entrant into the positive performers, I believe, either this week or last week. It might have crossed that line, as did health. So consumer staples is up over 2%. Healthcare also entrant there, up almost 50 basis points on a year-to-date basis. Utilities has been in and out of that kind of that podium, I guess you will, of the positive performers, and that is up 150 basis points or 1.5% for you equity folks out there on a year-to-date basis. Looking at what might have helped there, I'm taking a look at the month of November here. The S&P 500 was up over 5.5% for the month of November. Looking at there within the sectors, every single sector of the S&P 500, all 11 were positive on that month to date. And that was led by materials, up almost 12% in the month of November. But despite that, materials is still down. It looks like it's down over 6% on the year to date, but that definitely up almost 12%. Sure did help that that sector out there. Let's see here. Consumer staples and healthcare is what I pointed out earlier as being a new entrance into the podium of positive performers. And with that, consumer staples was up 6% in the month of November, and healthcare was up almost 5%. So definitely a nice little boost from that part of the the S&P ecosystem there.
I was impressed with your alliteration there of a podium of positive performers.
trying to bring some levity into my own mind as I'm going through some of these things here. I guess just the positive performers aren't helping. I got to come up with the alliteration as well. But scanning across the page here, just to kind of complete that roundup of positive performers in the equity world, Russell 1000, the large cap portion of the U.S. equity market for the month of November, up over 5%. Small caps represented through the Russell 2000, up over 2%. Russell 1000 growth up 4.5%, and Russell 1000 up 6.25%. And those are all on the month-to-date basis. Moving on over to the equity market, looks like bonds this week. Well, let's go over to the treasury market first here. Looks like across the curve on the treasury yield curve, it was up right around 20 basis points. So kind of down 20 basis points on the yields across the treasury curve. So kind of a parallel shift down in yields on the week ending December 2nd. 2-year treasury yield at 4.26%, 10-year treasury yield at 3.48%, and the bond at 3.53%. So that basically left the twos, tens yield differential unched for the week at negative 79 basis points in the inversion. Looks like the 3-month had a little bit more of a move there. So the 3-month 10-year spread inverted by another 20 basis points to close out this week at an inversion of just over 80 basis points there. So pretty big moves in the treasury market in terms of just the parallel shift down in yields where we got that rally there. Over on how that affected the bond aggregate, the ag was up 1.5% on the week-to-date basis, bringing the year-to-date number down to negative 11% on the year-to-date basis in the ag. So just like the S&P 500, getting a little bit of a clawback on those negative returns, being less negative there. But looking at this, I had to blink my eyes a couple times. Looking at the ag, I mean, that's a strong month. The ag for the month of November is up about 3.7% on the month, and that was led far and away by the EM sector, which is up 7.5% on the EM index there, followed closely by, or not so close, I guess, by USIG corporates, which was up over 5%. Similar to the equity market, every sector that we typically rattle off here on Monday Morning Minutes was also in the green for the month of November. The laggard here was the below investment grade corporate side here in the U.S., with bank loans up 1.25% and high yield corporate credit up about 2.2% on the month. So definitely some strong prints here. Looking at that ag print there in the context of that positive 3.7, it kind of blows away the commodity index. The Bloomberg commodity index was up also, but just up 2.75%. So it's not something you kind of see every day with such strong prints with the bond side of things kind of outperforming your commodity side, both in a strong market. 2.75% on the month in the Bloomberg. In the Bloomberg Commodity Index would be an otherwise strong month. But when you look at it compared to the ag up 3.7 and then the S&P 500 up 5.6, it does become the laggard here for the month of November.
Yeah, and to look at investment grade corporate bonds down, the index is down over 15% year to date. And so I know we've been talking in the past about the competition between the S&P and the corporate bonds down, almost a couple percent down more than the S&P. So definitely losing that battle there. And EM, even though it was down, it had a pretty big drawdown there, and we were thinking it was the worst performer. It is still the worst performer, but it's narrowed that gap. It's down 16.25% year to date. So, and not too much of a gap there between investment grade corporate bonds from the EM side of things. I guess when you're up 7.5% in a month, that certainly helps things a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a strange world too that we're actually comparing, you know, as we have for the last few months, the IG U.S. corporate credit bond market in terms of negative performance to the S&P 500. And we're, when you're kind of in the down double digits, down 15% type of world, I guess that's what you get. But the EM side of things, it looks like it did get a nice little boost here as I'm scanning for the dollar. The dollar was down 5%, so that certainly was served as a little bit of a tailwind for the positive performance in the EM markets today. So I see the DXY index at just under, today it's, just under 106 on the index level there. So rounding across that, let's just do the month-end roundup here. To complete it, the WTI crude oil futures on the front month contract, that was down 7% for the month of November. I see it closed today at a dollar price of, let's see, what do we got? Just over $80 $80 a barrel of WTI crude oil. It looks like gold futures on the front month contract there was up almost 6.5% for that month. And today it looks like it's just closed just $2 under the 1800 mark. So it couldn't hold that 1800 that I saw it touched intra week this week. So we'll see what the next couple of weeks have in store for gold. But right now gold is still hovering just about negative 2% on a year-to-date basis, but it has come up from some of the depths that I saw earlier this year. I see it as low as around 1600 a troy ounce. See if it gets over the 1800 mark by year end here.
Yeah, and oil then, was you know, it started the year at like 75.21. It looks like started the year per barrel. And you know, one point over the past couple of weeks actually dipped below that, and there were a lot of headlines of, you know, oil price now negative on the year, which you wouldn't have expected, especially over the summer or early you know, or before the early in the summer in like June when we were talking about is oil going to go to $200 a barrel, and here we are back down to, well, as you said, we're 80 now, but in the past couple of weeks we're down below that 75 level that we started the year at.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much in the news over the course of this year with regards to crude oil. Some of the things that we've hit on, from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve with the release of around 180 million barrels over the course of the last 6 to 8 months or so, that certainly has been the news. And then OPEC doing what they do with the control of the oil supply that they have through their quotas. That's also up for discussion, I believe, this Sunday, where they're also going to be meeting to talk about what their plans are for the upcoming month with oil production. And then, of course, you know, we'll have our soon-to-be topic of the week that we'll be discussing, and we can highlight that when we get to that in terms of the actual subject. But to round out the rest of the market here, it looks like Bitcoin managed to hold to go above and hold the 17,000 markets. That's 17,000 and some change here. It's still down 63% on the year. So by far and away the worst performer of the broader, well, I guess it's not an index, but a proxy for the digital asset space. It's by far and the, you know, away the worst performer when we use that as a proxy for the digital asset space across the broader asset classes that we look at. And on the flip side, you've got commodities still up over 17% on the year. So of the cohort that we look at, that's the only one with a positive sign in front of it. So it is the best performer on the year. So a lot can change, of course, between now and year end. So we'll keep monitoring this, and be interesting to see how we close the year.
Yep, definitely a lot going on. And given the volatility we saw in November, in terms of prices, we'll see how the rest of the year shakes out. So always December, light volume, or typically light volume. You have some, you know, tax incentives from people that maybe aren't as may move markets a little bit more than they do the rest of the year. So we'll kind of see. It'll be interesting to see how things shake out.
Indeed. So that wraps up the view of the market for this last week. Jeff, do you want to kick us off on what happened in the last 2 weeks in the macro front?
Yeah, we had a lot of data points, but this week was really the more important data points. Right before Thanksgiving, on that Wednesday, the 23rd, we did get the S&P Global Manufacturing PMI number came in below 50, came in at 47.6. So that was a pretty contractionary there. The services number came in at 46.1, so even more contractionary than the manufacturing side, but that was expected to be below 50 and expected to be 48. So not as big of a miss there, but both of the S&P Global PMI numbers showing contractions. We also got the FOMC meeting minutes right before Thanksgiving on that Wednesday. Wasn't really nothing too surprising there. So I guess I'll just kind of stop there. And from those highlights today, or this week, I should say, on Tuesday, we got the S&P CoreLogic 20 City Home Price Index. That number came in below expectations, just slightly below expectations. I was expected to be a negative 1.2 and came out at a negative 1.24, but that brought the year-over-year home price appreciation to 10.4%. So we're getting closer to what I would say is a more normal home price appreciation, that 20%, not normal, you know, low double digits, high single digits in terms of year-over-year seems to be a much more sustainable and normal type number. And then on Wednesday, we got the JOLTS job openings number that came in at 10.33 million. I was expected to be 10.25 million, so a little bit higher than expected. Still looking at the jobs market, still pretty strong. If you kind of back into the number, the job openings to the number of unemployed, that number is around 1.7, still well above where Jay Powell wants it to be, a 1.0. But you haven't really seen those job openings numbers come down. I mean, certainly higher than expected here, still above that 10 million level. So those numbers haven't really come down at all over the past few months. We also got the GDP, the second estimate of the third quarter of GDP came in higher than expectations at 2.9%. If you remember, the very first print we got was 2.4, so a pretty substantial increase there. Certainly not looking like, at least in the third quarter, we were in a recessionary environment. And then yesterday we got yesterday was a kind of a big day today. We got your personal income and personal spending. Personal income actually, it surprised to the upside, came in at 0.7 versus a 0.4 expectation. And personal spending came in flat as expected, or came in as expected at 0.8, wasn't flat at all, flat versus expectations. These are the strongest growth rates we've seen since October of last year. So some pretty good numbers there. We also got the PCE numbers that the Fed likes to look at. We got those on Thursday that came in month over month, came in at 0.3%. So down slightly from expectations. That brought the year over year number to 6. And then the core, so ex food and energy, came in at 0.2, slightly below expectations. And that brought the core number down to 5.0. So here we are, Fed still, that's the one the Fed wants to target at 2. So we're 5.0. So we're on the right track here, but still a long ways to go to get that 2. I feel like looking at 5.0 feels like it's much closer to 2 than we were, you know, when it was like 5.5, even though it's not that big of a difference to me. A five flat seems, you know, could almost be 4. So we're trending in the right direction there. On Thursday, we got the ISM manufacturing number that came in just slightly below expectations at 49. Sorry, Sam, were you going to say something about the PCE numbers?
Well, I was just going to say the inflation number definitely seems to be trending towards what Powell is looking for. And I think that was part of the reason why we such a strong rally in the bond market, especially. I'd have to take a look, but I bet that a lot of the big moves that we saw in yields and thus the ag itself probably centered around that first, you know, the CPI report that we had earlier in the month. But just that PCE number really just kind of backed it up a bit. I'm not going to say it solidified it, but it was a little bit more to give Powell a little bit what he's hoping for to see, I guess, at least from that standpoint, the inflation standpoint.
That's right. And I was going to say reinforced is how I was thinking about it. It kind of reinforced that the data is turning in the right direction.
Yep.
Then today we did get today's Pizza Friday. I should have had pizza for lunch, but I didn't realize it was Pizza Friday. We did get the non-farm payroll numbers. That number came in at 263,000. That was a beat. It was expected to be 200,000. So pretty good beat there. Still the lowest level we've seen since April of 2021, but still, again, showing very strong labor market. You did see the unemployment rate came in as expected at 3.7. The underemployment rate didn't really move at 6.7. So again, strong numbers in the labor market. And then the labor force participation rate kind of surprisingly came in below expectations. It was expected to be at the 62.3 and came in at 62.1. If you do look at the, this is one of those data, or this is one of those data days where, depending on your outlook, you could have seen different, you could take what you want, whether you're looking at the establishment survey or the household survey, and depending on which one you want to look at, the labor force participation getting weak. If you wanted to look at the non-farm payroll still staying very strong, you could look at that as a point pointing to a strong labor market. So again, we're at this weird inflection point where we don't really know what the labor market's going to do. You have a lot of headlines on layoffs, but you really haven't seen those numbers come through in any of the jobless claims data yet. And one of the things to note is that the BLS, so the Bureau of Labor Statistics, highlighted that the response rate for the establishment survey this week, which is the one that uses for the payroll data, that the response rate was very low for November. And so there's for those of you that are in the bearish camp, you think that the economy is weaker or the labor market is weaker than the numbers say, you can point to that, and that we should look and see whether there's some downward revisions from those numbers when they get revised next month. And then finally, Sam, as you said, all eyes are on the Fed. Some of the inflation data came out, and you did get the rare Jay Powell speech. I guess rare compared to the other Fed members. He did speak on Wednesday. Both his prepared statement and the Q&A basically said, kind of reinforced the same data points from the last Fed meeting, that they're focused on inflation, the yields may be higher, or yields meaning Fed funds rate may be higher and for longer than investors expect. The labor market is too strong with a recession, and then a recession is an acceptable cost of fighting inflation, though they don't expect or shooting for a recession. And really, I think that people were taking that as the Fed is going to, use finger quotes and say pivot. And their pivot is from 75 basis point rate hikes to 50 basis point rate hikes. So that's what constitutes a pivot these days, as opposed to rate cuts. But it certainly seems like the Fed, Nick Timiraos came out and said today that the labor market data keeps the Fed on track for a 50 basis point rate hike on December 14th, which is the next Fed meeting. So it seems like that's pretty much a done deal, even though we do get a CPI data point, I believe, on the 13th. So all eyes on that CPI data, and to kind of see how the market reacts to that.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of a pivot, it just seems like people are trying to be very hopeful here, but I'd just rather go into this thing eyes wide open, because it doesn't look like he's made any in terms of changes or concessions in his speech. He's basically saying the same things that he's been saying since the presser for the most part during that period of time. So, looking at the calendar here, we are going into the blackout period for Fed speak. December 14th is the FOMC, the Wednesday for the meeting and the press conference. And looking it up on calendar as well, I see the CPI is going to be released the day before on the 13th, which is what I think you said. So Tuesday is the CPI, Wednesday. So I guess they can digest that on the first day of their 2-day meeting before coming out on the 13th. But I'm pretty sure a lot of their minds have probably been made up already. And that 50 basis point increase, which is not a pivot in my mind again. Pretty sure it's not yours, is probably in the works there. So we'll see what that day holds.
Powell's been pretty consistent in his messaging. It's just pretty interesting how the market reacts, and we'll have to see whether the press conference and the statement tries to reinforce what he's been saying and try to get the market to react the way they want. I don't think they would necessarily would have wanted the stock market to rally so much on the back of Powell saying higher for longer, and that they're still focused on inflation and labor market strong.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if they're saying.
That's what he's been saying.
Exactly. So. Yeah. I would say that if there's any divergence, maybe it's, from within the FOMC, members, even the voting members there, maybe he's becoming one of the minorities in terms of maintaining kind of this viewpoint relative to others who may be taking more of a dovish pivot, if you will. But I do agree with you that he's been rather consistent in his language and not wanting to deviate from that. So, of course, that point of deviation could come from the CPI, but we'll see, because as he has been saying that he is data dependent. And one thing of note, too, that December 14th, it's probably going to be a pretty light week in terms of, you know, in terms of staffing on a lot of these trading desks. So it could make for some interesting times, depending on how he, Jay Powell, handles the press conference.
That's right. Well, with that, let's move on to the topic of the week. And I want to do a quick little follow-up to our last topic of the week, which was on November 18th. We talked about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, as Sam kind of hinted at earlier in the market wrap-up section. And that it was interesting, as we talked about, the Biden administration has said that they want to refill the SPR around, you know, call it $70 a barrel in terms of oil. And this come out that they do say that they want to do that, but also that there already are planned sales. And Sam, I can't remember what episode we talked about the SPR again, but it was really something where we talked about how they're planned sales because they need to raise money for some unfunded legislation Congress does, and so that the Energy Department is saying that they want to cancel or delay sales mandated by Congress in fiscal years 2024 through 2027, because they want to buy oil, you know, refill the SPR at around $70 a barrel. And Congress has mandated that they would sell $147 million a barrel over those three fiscal years, including 35 million barrels in 2024. And so, you know, we thought it was a pretty funny quote where the deputy director for the Office of Petroleum Reserves said in testimony that it doesn't make sense for us to be releasing oil when we're trying to refill the SPR. We can't fill and release from the same site at the same time. So, you know, this is what you get into that conundrum of, hey, we're trying to release oil to keep oil prices low, but in the future we're going to be releasing more, but we don't want to sell those now because we need to refill. It just shows kind of the, at least in my mind, the short-sightedness of that SPR release that happened over the past 6 months or so.
Yeah. So while you're talking, I looked it up. It looks like November 12th, 2021 was when we talked about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We talked about the levels. We talked about how, I want to say it was shortly after the global financial crisis where the Congress, I guess, decided to use the Strategic Petroleum Reserve as a potential funding mechanism to plug the gap in the annual deficits there, I guess it shouldn't be too shocking to see them take away that that piece of funding now, especially as they've been using it tactically, you know, both at the first time to plug the gap in the fiscal deficit, and then now they're trying to plug the, or I guess close the, bring down prices of oil, you know, through the actual release of the reserve. And then at least they do have a little bit of that foresight to say that, hey, maybe we should bring it back up. But I think that is also a legislatively mandated level that they can only get to a certain minimum, which I can't remember exactly how close they're getting to that lower bound, but certainly closer than they were a year ago.
Closer than they've ever been.
That's right, except for when they're actually filling it, because we are right back down to the early 80s type level, and that memory serves, I think the first barrels started going into this reserve in the mid to late 70s there. So it's the other way around, bro, in terms of the way that we've been taking the inventory there.
Yep. Well, let's keep the topic on oil and politics, and let's talk about something that's coming up here on Monday, which is the Russian oil price, and I'm going to put another finger quotes here, cap. So why don't you you want to hit up the background on this oil price cap or alleged oil price cap? And you know, I guess starting off, I kind of hinted at our or at least my conclusion of being politics and how that kind of is going to affect things.
Yeah, so it all kind of ties together, and this all comes back to, I guess, where if we start thinking about when Russia invaded the Ukraine back in late February or so, and I guess the G7, let's just call them the group of seven countries, largely the more industrialized countries, the US, Canada, UK, Germany, France, Italy, and Japan, they wanted to put some punitive measures on Russia through sanctions, I believe is what they initially wanted, just a global sanction. But then as we were talking about, the U.S. and the administration began releasing barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve back at the end of March, and that was to stop oil prices from going any higher. If anything, it was to bring oil prices back down. So I think the G7, primarily the U.S., figured out pretty quickly that if they just put a global sanction on oil, similar to what they had done with Iran and Venezuela in previous years, then that could lead to a counteracting effect on the price of oil, as you know, the supply shock, given that Russia produces and exports about 10-12% of global production and exports. So they are a major player there. But putting an outright sanction on that would disrupt the oil market further, causing oil prices to potentially skyrocket even higher from where they were. So back in June, initially, it was the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. They announced outright bans on Russian oil. The European Union had announced a plan to ban seaborne imports of Russian crude oil, as well as other fuels. But they did allow for the import of oil to the European Union via existing pipelines. So that was kind of a little bit of a half measure there. And then later on in September, the G7 decided to implement decided that a price cap would needed to be implemented. And I do think back in that September meeting is when they pegged this December 5th date, which is why we're talking about today. But they talked about the need to implement a price cap on all seaborne deliveries of Russian crude oil and petroleum products that were purchased globally and not just to the European Union. So in doing so, they were looking to limit the access to enforce this by limiting the access to European insurance and financing to help facilitate oil purchases. These are absolutely critical for seaborne purchases to have the insurance and financing there. But the way that they can restrict this and enforce it is by not providing those that insurance and financing to those countries that did not agree to the cap. That was announced in that September meeting, but as we'll talk about subsequent here, there was not much agreement around what the actual price cap itself would be, and that's what we just found out today, I believe, this morning, right, Mayberry, in terms of the actual level that they're willing to implement it at, as there was a lot of discussion around that. Some countries wanted it to be higher, to be a little bit more restrictive. Others wanted it to be a little bit lower. But just as more background, about 95% of the world's oil tanker fleet that is covered by firms in terms of the insurance and financing arm through the UK and the European Union. So there definitely is that lever to pull for seaborne trade for Russian crude oil. One thing that complicated it, though, as I alluded to, is that you needed all 27 member states of the European Union to give unanimous approval to that actual level. So again, that was decided today. On the back of this, and basically for the last few months, Russia has been saying that in light of this move towards a price cap, that it will not supply crude oil, refined products, or gas to any nations that decide to introduce and abide by these price caps on Russian oil. And instead, they will look for alternative markets for those that don't abide by this price cap. And as such, since the initial ban had been contemplated, you know, going back as early as, I guess you could say, April or so of this year, Russia has already been in discussions with China, India, and some other countries largely within the Asia-Pacific region about ensuring shipments through Russia's very own national reinsurance company. So with that, we've also seen China and India continue to buy this discounted oil, as one would expect, to, you know, the more global benchmark of Brent crude oil. In some instances, I've seen quotes of Russian crude oil being purchased by these countries at anywhere between 48 and somewhere around, you know, in the mid 40s to kind of the high 50s type of dollar prices where these things have actually been executed at. But one of the considerations that the EU has to find somewhat sensitive is that whether or not Russia in that, if they do decide not to supply crude oil to some of these other countries that don't abide by the price cap, what that means for the existing pipeline of natural gas supplies that Europe has been so dependent on Russia there. So a lot is kind of on the line on this, depending on how Russia decides if they want to retaliate against this. But as I mentioned, there was a decision today in terms of an agreement on the actual initial level of this price cap. Jeff, I know you did a little bit of work on that. Did you want to let us know what you found out?
Yeah, they said that they agreed to a price cap of $60 a barrel. And they say the $60 a barrel of, quote, petroleum oil. So, you know, there's a lot of different grades of, I was confused. That's what we talked about a couple of weeks ago, SPR and different grades, sweet and sour crude in the U.S. And so different grades of oil. And so they did say, you know, $60 per barrel, didn't talk about what kind of oil it was. So some of those types of oil already trade below the price cap of $60 a barrel, some slightly above. But they did say that they would evaluate that price cap every couple months. And with their aim, you know, again, aim in quotes being to keep that price cap about $5 a barrel below where Russia's selling it. So they are of the opinion Russia's selling oil at $65 a barrel. So they're going to put the price cap at 60. But as you said, Sam, they've been, it seems like Russia's really been selling it to China and India and trying, and they're selling, you know, I think you have written down here $900,000 barrels a day. There's really a case of Russia shifting their oil exports towards India and China being the ones that are maybe not necessarily as on board with the price caps and not as on board with any sort of sanctions, and they're trying to take advantage of the situation. Now it'll be interesting to see that, as I think you mentioned that OPEC is meeting I think you said on Sunday, so it'll be interesting to see whether they try to keep oil up. You know, if they cut production, obviously oil will go higher. Do they keep it above that price cap and try to limit how much money Russia gets from their oil, or do they actually try to keep prices even lower and try to make the price cap even less of a issue, and try to reinforce the fact that they're the only cartel out there that can control the price of oil, and that even if the G7 and Eurozone countries are out there saying we're not going to buy oil, or we're not going to, you know, we're going to put an effective price cap at $60 a barrel, that how is that going to work? So it'll be interesting to see early next week, at least here Pacific time, whether or how OPEC Plus deals with that.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. It's in the fact that OPEC and OPEC Plus, including Russia there, yeah, you know, it's a consortium or cartel, if you want to call them that, I do, of oil producing region or countries, right? I'm sure they don't really like the idea of the G7s forming their own cartel of buyers there. So we'll see when push comes to shove who wins out here. But ultimately, it's one of those things, right? I mean, if you're going to see cheap prices out there for certain things that are critical to your infrastructure and your economy, guess what? I'm pretty certain that if there's a will, there's a way, right? So like you said, India is one of the things that I noted that prior to this conflict, India actually imported very little oil from Russia prior to this, but now they're one of their top importers there. And, you know, I'm guessing that they're probably going to continue to be as long as they can get that cheap oil. And then China, specifically, I saw that it was mentioned China, but I'm sure other countries are doing this too. But they're finding different ways to circumvent some of these rules as well in terms of the insurance and financing basis, because China apparently was making some of their purchases of Russian oil, making it on the delivery basis rather than on the basis of shipment. And what that nuance does is it leaves the responsibility of the shipping and financing and insurance cost with the sellers of the Russian oil. So perhaps the Russian firms that were selling the oil were more comfortable with the Russian national reinsurance company insuring it there, and you know, not avoiding it, and China being able to kind of avoid it from that standpoint. And then, of course, the other nuances, you know, the currency in which some of these these oil purchases are being made, it seems like China's now more than happy to be purchasing it in RMB or the yuan instead of US dollars, which I think Russia, given the sanctions on their currency, are more than happy to do as well. So you know, you're seeing a lot of creativity around these purported sanctions and price caps there, but you know, we've seen it time and time again. I mean, we mentioned before that there's been these longstanding sanctions against Iran and Venezuela, but guess what? Trade has continued to happen around there, and it just involves some fancy, I've seen it described as overnight clandestine type of transfers, you know, both the shipping documents, but then also from ship to ship of the cargo in the middle of the night. So pretty sure that this type of situation could and probably has been happening around Russia oil as well. But I think a key catalyst is just you can't forget the levers that Russia has as well. I mean, they could just refuse to, you know, to ship any of the oil, again, as they've been threatening, to those that abide by the price cap, thus eliminating the global supply of oil and causing a potential price shock there. But then also immediately to the European Union countries, what happens if they cut off the natural gas supplies there, and what's already shaping up to be a tough winter there for those countries?
Yeah, so definitely, I think that you're going to see some. I wasn't going to say shenanigans, but there's going to be some goings on there that you know, some second order effects, and it'll be interesting to see how things shake out and whether you know, it's just pure political theater of a $60 price cap, or whether it actually has some teeth to it.
Yeah, it definitely will be interesting to see what happens next week and what the response mechanisms will be.
So I guess we'll look forward to what we can talk about an update on that next week. And with that, thanks for that summary, Sam. Let's get on to the things to keep an eye on next week. It should be a pretty light week. On Monday, we get the ISM services number. That number is expected to come at 53.5 versus the 54.4 the prior month. As always, on Thursday, we get the jobless claims numbers. Those numbers are still pretty low, so keep an eye on those, whether they start to tick up. And then on Friday, kind of the big day, I think, is the PPI number. We do have large month-over-month numbers starting to roll off here over the next few months. We have a 0.2% month-over-month number expected. That would bring the year-over-year number to 7.2, down from 8.0, so a big move there. Starting to feel, again, a little more comfortable with that inflation number. If you look at PPI ex food and energy, again, 0.2 expected month over month, and that would bring the year over year number to 5.9. So, you know, as we continue to say, we're probably past, you know, peak inflation. On Friday, we do get the University of Michigan inflation expectations number. You know, always take that number with a grain of salt, as Sam and I have talked about before. And then, as you noted, and as I wanted to note, there's a Fed blackout starts tomorrow. On December 3rd. So no Fed speak next week. So it should be a pretty quiet week from at least from that perspective.
Yeah, I'm all for quiet weeks, you know, especially as we get into the year-end roundup here.
Yep, exactly. And then, you know, next week will not be a quiet week. So, you know, I guess we'll rest up and get ready to strap in for CPI and the Fed.
That's right. Strap in, everyone.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for this week, Sam. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks, everyone, for listening to us today on Monday Morning Minutes. You can pick us up each Monday before the bell on any of your favorite podcast platforms. And if you're not finding us somewhere, let us know about it. We'll try to get it on deck for you there. And to do so, you can email us at minutes@doubleline.com, or you can hit us up on the Twitter at @DLineMinutes. Please send in any questions or topics that you'd like us, me, Jeff, and I to hit up for our topic of the week session.
Yeah, and don't forget, you can find more information about DoubleLine at our website, doubleline.com. YouTube channel is youtube.com/doubleline capital. We have the most recent episode of Channel 11 News out there, season 3, episode 9. We have a quick Jeff Sherman podcast, video podcast episode, and then most recent episode of the Sherman Show titled Other Way Around, Bro. And make sure to follow Sam. And Sam, I don't think you're on that one. I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet. I don't think you're on that one. But it's, you know, it will be an interesting episode. And one of the ones that I want to watch as opposed to just listen. So that's why I haven't gotten to it yet. Make sure to follow Sam and Jeff on Twitter at Sherman Show Pod, and hope everyone has a great week.
Yeah, thanks everyone, and good luck out there.
The audio presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without the expressed written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates make any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Liability, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk. Copyright 2022, DoubleLine.